2-2 pitch. A swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
Everybody, JJ and Jeff back together again. JJ Cooper, Jeff Ponce here on the Fantasy Podcast. Normally we get together on the Prospect Pod, but this week, doing something a little different here, Jeff. We're going to talk a little fantasy baseball as well. You are one of our fantasy experts. I am a host who also has enough insight to add something, but we're going to rely heavily on you in this pod today.
Yeah, no, appreciate that. You know, little unusual. Typically, we're up a little bit earlier, but last night there was no way that I was going to get Dylan to record during that game four of the Blue Jays Yankees series, especially considering it ended at 10:30, and it's the first time they've made the ALCS in quite a long time. So kind of letting him do his thing. So we'll talk a little bit. It's also probably the deadest 3 weeks of the year on the fantasy calendar, at least, because there aren't many leagues that have FYPDs or anything going on right now. Most of my leagues, I can't trade or make any free agent moves at this point. Really only my Arizona Fall League fantasy league that kicked off this week. I did get a big performance from Cole Mathis last night. Little 3-for-3. No home runs, though. When I see a 3-for-3 in Arizona and there's no extra base hits, I will be honest, I'm a little disappointed. When I saw a 3-for-3, and I was like, all right, we got a homer here. And it was like, nope, three singles. He drove in some runs, but it was three singles.
I was going to say, like, so I do love AFL fantasy leagues because, like, the insights on how long is this player going to stick around is one of the most important parts of figuring out who to take.
I almost preferred to take, I picked the back end of the first round. So, like, I didn't have any of, like, the Kevin McGonigals and, like, those kind of guys. A lot of them in that early period aren't showing up. You know, or could be there for 9 days and then they're gone, right?
What would you put? And I have not done any reporting on this. I'm not saying that someone from the Tigers has told me or anything like that. This is pure speculation. But if you told me that, I'm not saying he won't, but if you asked me for the odds that Kevin McGonigal is there for the entirety of the AFL, I would put it below 50-50 because he had, you know, I know he missed some time, but he had a pretty full season. Successful season.
Yeah, and he was back from, you know, it was an ankle injury, right? Was back from that pretty quickly, considering it wasn't like just like a soft tissue, you know, felt a little sore, low grade sprain type of thing. Like, he had a legitimate injury, so that's part of it too. I thought he looked kind of gassed at times in the playoffs, so I was a little surprised that they sent him out to Arizona. They don't have a complex out there where I feel like I can understand it a little bit more for those teams that are based in Arizona, JJ, because, you know, there might be some load monitoring stuff or a coach that they want him working with out there. And it's like, well, we can get you into some games to try some of these things out. That makes a lot more sense when you're an East Coast Florida team.
Lakeland to like Phoenix is a, it's a haul.
I'm almost a little shocked, and, you know, I'm a little shocked that he didn't get pulled before the season. I think we all kind of anticipated that there was an outside shot that he maybe didn't even end up at AFL.
I would throw this out. I think the logic of him being in the AFL right now, there is a logic to it, which is he's staying hot, and it doesn't mean I know. I've heard from Tigers fans. I know that there's a lot of Tigers fans who want Kevin McGonigal to be their shortstop right now in the postseason. I get that. At the same time, it does. I know he's not on their taxi squad. He could, you know, there's taxi squads. You could do that kind of thing too. But they are keeping him hot. If they had an injury and all of a sudden you're like, oh, what are we going to do? Having McGonigal ready to go is not a bad thing. Like, that's not a bad thing, but that's, you know, and they're still playing right now as we record this, still going. So I can see that. Now, again, don't misunderstand me. That is not me saying, why is Kevin McGonigal not the Tiger shortstop? You've seen him play shortstop. I've watched him play shortstop. I don't think you want Kevin McGonigal being your everyday shortstop in the postseason right now.
No, I don't think that's I don't think that's saying anything, you know, outrageous or crazy or anything along those lines. Sure.
If again, if they did have an injury, if Baez went down, you know, if they had something happen saying that, hey, we're bringing Kevin McGonigal over, makes a whole lot of sense. And having him playing in games to where his timing is, you know, right there where it should be, all that, that all makes sense. That's partly why I do think, like, at some point, it wouldn't shock me if they're like, okay, Kevin's, you know, Kevin's heading home now. He's gotten in what he needs to. But speaking of postseason and all that, one of the things that we wanted to start with as we kind of look towards 2026, I feel like it was the September, October of the dominating debutante pitcher. Like, we had obviously Cam Schlittler, who there's a piece up at Baseball America right now. Like, that was a playoff ace. Like, we will see. Like, if you said project what he's going to do in the future, different story. We'll talk about that. But if you said Cam Schlittler, was he a playoff ace? Yes. 100% yes. Because I would say, if you said, what are the definitions of a number of an ace, right? One, you go deep in games. And two, on top of that, I would say also, like, you obviously have to have great success. He had one start in the postseason where he was utterly dominant with some of the best stuff we'll ever see. But then he had a second start where his stuff was not at its top tier, and he still figured out a way to battle through it. And again, I point that out because he went over 14 innings those two starts, and we haven't seen literally any MLB starter do that in the postseason and back-to-back starts in 22, 23, 24, or otherwise in 25. No Scooble, no anyone. He's done that. The last guy who did that was Logan Webb. And if you look at the list of guys who do that, who have done that since 2015, it's just aces. John Lester in his prime is kind of like the low end of what we're talking about there. But Jeff, as you watch Cam Schlittler, who, by the way, we also should note, you know, had 14 excellent starts in the big leagues. Had one of the most amazing stories of development and taking, when we talk about a guy taking the leap, it's kind of hard to, that is the definition of taking the leap, when you have a guy who literally over the course of the season added 5 miles an hour to his standard velocity. Don't see that very often. But what do you think going forward? How sustainable is this?
I think it's pretty sustainable. And I think you saw him in a huge spot against a really good lineup. I think that Red Sox lineup that we saw in the playoffs at that point was somewhat depleted. I don't think that's, you know, any knock on what they did this season. It was a good year for them, but losing Roman Anthony, not having Marcelo Meyer as sort of a backup option, I think, you know, in certain spots probably hurt some of the depth. You know, Willie Abreu was not right after the injury, just sort of didn't come back hard. Alex Bregman really struggled down the stretch. The Blue Jays are the opposite. This was a team that hit well all season long, almost reminiscent in terms of how they score runs. Obviously, some of these guys are the same. Some of them aren't as big of names. It's not that different from like those prime Astros teams where I felt like the defining characteristic of their offense was they didn't have a lot of guys that ever struck out. They all had really long, engaging at bats. And it wasn't just not chasing. It's also fighting off pitches in the edge of the zone that you don't want to hit, right? They do that really well and extend at bats. That's a tough lineup to strike out. He didn't have a lot of strikeouts last night. He didn't walk anybody in either of these. And against both of those lineups in the playoffs, not walking anybody is a big deal. The other thing is we do have 73 innings here, 14 starts in the big leagues, above average strikeout numbers, 27.6%, K percentage, 8.4% walk percentage. I know in fantasy we tend to use K per nine and walks per nine because we're trying to extrapolate out all those sort of things. It's an 11.62 K per nine and a 3.05 walk per nine. So really, really good numbers, 2.82 ERA. The ERA estimators are all right within in line. Excuse me, 2.96 ERA.
Yeah, 2.96. Yeah.
Yeah, I read his minor league stats. And ERA estimators are pretty much in line, 3.74 FIP, 3.77 xFIP. For a rookie, and I think that there were even some adjustments in the last few starts, and especially what we saw in the playoffs, that could springboard him up even further. I think the issue that we're going to run into in fantasy, at least, isn't necessarily the production, but what the cost of acquisition is going to be for Schlittler. He's already a Yankees player, which you get more press, all that sort of thing, you know. But beyond it, the way that he performed, and as young as he is, and he throws really hard and all those things, it might actually price him out of a reasonable spot. Like, it might, you're going to have to right. invest quite a bit, either in a redraft, a startup draft, or in the trade market to acquire Schlittler. It's just, and I think last night is probably going to push it even further, because you did get really deep into that start. And I think one thing that isn't a straight category in most leagues, there are some leagues now that are using innings pitched as a category. Innings matter for starters in fantasy, because even if the rate stats, the K per nine, whatever it might be, isn't as good, it is with Schiller. But if it isn't, you eventually accumulate numbers. It's why Logan Webb is always more valuable than if you just look at K per nine numbers and that sort of thing on an annual basis. Because he gets deep into starts, he accumulates innings, you know, he helps your ratios. And while the K per start numbers might be low, he makes enough starts and throws enough innings that he accumulates enough of those numbers. It's about counting stats. I think people forget that, particularly in Roto, but it's no different in head-to-head. So, yeah, I think Schlittler is probably going to be valuable, but I don't know how much Schlittler I'm gonna have next year, just because he's probably going to be priced around
he's
guys.
He's too that, good.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be in, like, Freddie Peralta, Dylan Cease kind of range in terms of like a high end number two, low end number one. But it wouldn't shock me if in some drafts he creeps up into that area. I think that there's just not going to be a lot of value, but he's good. And I think in Dynasty, you can kind of invest in it for a number of years. And obviously there's some runway there and some track record.
Okay. So that kind of then leads me to phrase another question kind of off that. If you were looking at it as far as projecting ahead, and you're comparing him, speaking of another postseason star we've seen, who may add to his hype because we know that the Blue Jays are still going on, but Treya Savage, like I would say right now, you know, I would say as far as the notoriety, the hype, all that is probably running at a slightly lower level than Schlittler, even though Treya Savage has been ranked higher, been, you know, a more prominent prospect at every step of the, you know, first round pick versus seventh, you know, all these things. But is he, like, how would you match those two up?
Yeah, so it's funny because I still think we're catching up on Savage, even in terms of where he should rank. Obviously he had a phenomenal start the other night. You know, was pretty good in his I guess, you know, three trio of appearances, all starts, but only totaling 14 innings. You know, the underlying stuff is really good. I think from a pure swing and miss standpoint, he's going to rack up more whiffs than Schlittler is. I don't know if he has as many out generating skills in terms of getting weak contact and kind of having the deep arsenal of power pitches that Schlittler does. Throwing a couple of different fastball variations, the cutter, of course, you know, and then a couple other breaking balls on top of that. With Savage, it's really unusual, right? I think that's the biggest thing, is he has an arsenal where nothing really moves to the glove side, which I think, I wonder here, this is the question I have. Because of that, it's really unique. But is that something that hitters will never adjust to, or is it something that they'll eventually adjust to and he's going to need something that moves more glove side? I don't know. You know, typically with guys like this, it's not an art. It's not a slider that's moving glove side, right? It's not a curveball that has very little glove side break. It's mostly guys that just don't have a breaking ball at all. And I don't think that's necessarily the case with
you. That's not the case with him.
Yeah, it's not a
plus. But it's an up and down breaking ball. It's not.
Yeah, but it's more average, and it's kind of like a cutter-ish slider. But that splitter is filthy. It's a very deceptive arm angle. He generates a ton of ride from that arm slot as well. And despite it being very over the top, and there's a certain level of expected ride that comes with an arm slot like that, it still rides so much more than almost any other four seam fastball that a guy is going to see. It still plays, and there's a lot of velocity there, and he throws a lot of strikes. The thing that's lingering, and is kind of the unsaid thing with Yesavage, that certainly was something we covered a lot because we covered him in the draft, is the questions around the injuries. And it's not the acupuncture incident that happened leading up to the tournament last year.
No.
It's shoulder and elbow stuff. And I've had people tell me that more or less that slot is the only way that he can throw. There can't be any adjustments made there because it could lead to some further medical stuff. That said, he threw a lot of innings this year. He was really effective, and he was really effective in October when the team needed him. So the team's confident in him. I do think he has a rotation spot next year. I just don't know if I can anticipate him throwing 160, 170 innings, which I feel pretty comfortable with Cam Schlittler saying, I can stamp this guy for 150 and there's upside for 180. Like, it's going to be somewhere in that range where I would probably put the number between 120 and 150 for Yesavage next season. So I do think there's some trade-off there. I think Yesavage probably goes later than him in most drafts, but there's upside. There's upside that's worth gambling on.
That's kind of the fascinating, like the balance we're kind of asking about here. Okay, so we got to throw two more in here, which is, we also saw, speaking of guys who are postseason bloody now, they've got their experience. Connelly Early is another guy who's kind of taken steps forward. Like, I mean, I get it. Like, I will say, we get now more and more when you want, if you want examples of why it's not day two anymore because the draft's been truncated, but that third to 10th round range is the, oh, let's find some college arms area of the draft. And it's almost like you could almost hear teams being excited, like, this guy's terrible right now. It's going to be awesome for us because we can fix this, this, and this. And Logan Evans, to just use an example of that, because check out Logan Evans college numbers versus his major league numbers so far, but we can improve him. Connelly Early was a guy who was good in college. I don't want to make it sound like he wasn't, but he's taken steps forward, him and Peyton Tolley. I would say Schlittler is probably the guy I would see as the best for next year and beyond out of this group. But at the same time, like you said, when you talk about price versus performance, that's what I'm asking you about. How do you see those guys kind of fitting into this?
Yeah. And I think both of these guys have a really good shot at being in this rotation next year. After Crochet, I frankly think a lot of it could change. I think of the guys they have under contract right now who are healthy, because I think Giolito might have an opt-out after this season. Crochet and Bayo. And that's kind of it. They made some roster moves, obviously, to clear spots for Tolley. Early comes up, actually out-pitches Tolley. More professional innings with him. I think his development path at this point, we're now 2 years into this plan of him adding velocity and all sort of things, and Early and Tolley was in year one, and it was a pretty big velocity jump, and obviously jumped a ton of levels, pitched more than he ever had in his life. Early's a guy where, you know, he's got a couple of 100 plus inning seasons, 103.2 last year, 119.2, so just under 120. Actually, if you include the playoffs, over 120 this year. I think you can kind of pencil in Early as their number three starter. Couple of lefties there, right? And you can expect him to go 140 to 160. Like, I don't think that's an unreasonable jump just based on what his, jumping sort of 20 innings a season or more. And if he stays healthy, I think the performance is there. He gets ground balls. He gets swings and misses. I wouldn't say that it's like plus command, or it's kind of like in that range of like average to above average. He doesn't walk a lot of guys, but the walk rates aren't elite. And he misses bats in the right parts of the zone. There's not a lot of middle misses for Early either. Has a few different breaking ball shapes that work. He's got, I think, a plus changeup. Has multiple different variations of that changeup. And he's got two different variations of his fastball that both graded out really well at the major league level. So I think you look at all these traits, he gets swings and misses out of the zone. He gets swings and misses in the zone. Gets a decent amount of called strikes as well. I think that number will probably go up as he gets more and more comfortable in the major leagues. So Early's the one that I would bet on. That said, the floor is higher there. And I think you do draft for floor somewhat in fantasy. Projections are going to look heavily at floor. Toley has the higher ceiling, right? That if he takes another step forward, and let's say that the slider or the changeup or both take a half a grade jump, and we're talking about two above average to maybe plus pitches, right? And he's got that 70, maybe even 80 grade fastball. He holds that velocity. He's throwing strikes and working. He's the kind of guy where a year from now, we could be talking about a top 20 starter in the majors. But I think the downside is he doesn't have as many innings, and we do need to see, you know, that step forward with the secondaries. Not that they're bad pitches, but they're just not of the same quality in terms of the overall quality of the arsenal that I think we see with Early, and just his ability to be able to execute all those, despite having a fastball that's at least a grade to maybe a grade and a half or two lower than what Toley's is. I do think they're both going to end up in the rotation. A couple of lefties, obviously, it's really outlier with Toley. I think he just, you know, it was a long season. He needs to get his feet wet, and it'll be year two as a professional where we see a lot of these guys take a big jump. So both really, really interesting names.
One thing I will bring up that I can't actually add to this, which is the other thing that stands out with most of these guys, really well, but especially, I would say, Schlittler at the top of this list. We do have a study over at baseballamerica.com. I wanted to find out something because, you know, whenever I talk, I love velocity. I've always loved velocity. It is foundational to me that for a pitcher, not that there aren't successful examples otherwise, but for a pitcher, the foundation of success is premium velocity. Any other way that you are doing it is putting a lot of stress on everything else. And every time I say that, the answer I always get back is, oh yeah, but, and again, I think that there's a perception with someone like Cam Schlittler that this is going to be someone who's great for a very short period of time, and then he's going to blow out, and then he's going to disappear, and you are just better off. Like, you know that if you're going that way, that's what you're getting. And that's what the study tried to look at. And I looked at every starting pitcher made their major league debut 2008 to 2015 of any significance, 10 starts or more, basically, in the majors. And it is overwhelming that if you look at that, and this is modern era, because, I mean, obviously, this includes the Kershaws, the Scherzers, and a lot of guys who aren't at that level, every pitcher, right? Every starting pitcher. But the overarching thing that stands out is that if you want to have success, the most important thing you can have is premium velocity. That's the most important thing. Like, I'm not saying that there are we can talk about movement, we can talk about command, we can talk about deception, we can talk about all these other things. But when you talk about the most successful pitchers in baseball, they are ones who generally throw, I use the term velocity delta, they throw 2 miles an hour or more harder than the average starter who throws with that hand, because a lefty starter and a righty starter, two different things. Got to look at those differently. But we see that. We also see the other thing that I think is probably has some utility from a fantasy perspective is when you see the below average velocity pitcher who has success, we've seen a lot of those who do, like Dallas, again, in this study, Dallas Keuchel, Kyle Hendricks, Trevor Cahill, Mike Leake, guys like that. they rarely sustain that success in their 30s in the way that when we talk about the Kevin Gausmans, the Zach Wheelers, the Justin Verlanders, the Max Scherzers. You know, you could just go through all these guys who sustained it. And yes, I know that someone's going to have in their head, well, what about Jacob deGrom? What about Steven Strasburg? There are guys who blow out. But even in the case of those guys who blow out, Strasburg was a above average starter basically until he couldn't pitch anymore. Jacob deGrom was an above average starter this year as a 37-year-old. So there is this component of all this, I would say, that does just kind of jump out that velocity. If it's not everything, we're not saying it's everything, but it is kind of a key to durability, which I think is kind of counter to at least some conventional wisdom. Having that margin of error, we saw it with Schlittler in the playoffs. When you throw 99 touching 101 in your first start, and then your next start, you're 97 touching 99. You still have above average stuff, where if you are sitting 94 and then you come out in your next start and you're sitting 92, that's going to be a lot tougher job to get hitters out, especially in the zone, which is what you have to do nowadays. So that's something that really does kind of jump out, that does kind of fit to what we're talking about here. All these guys do carry with them premium velocity, which I would say we've seen a lot with young starters in recent years. I would say the other thing with Jeff about that is that, and I would say Schlittler early are especially examples of this, of how velocity, you know, it used to be that we thought that velocity was something you either had or you didn't, but velocity very much is a commodity that can be developed nowadays. Not for everyone, but if you have the building blocks, if you can smooth out the delivery, if you can get stronger, velocity can be developed, right?
Yeah, I would say the only guy that we just talked about that had somewhat of the same velocity, like Yesavage is up a little bit, but had velo and kind of looked like this when he was at ECU, is like early Tolley and Schlittler, all guys that had multiple mile per hour bumps. It's early is probably 3 miles an hour. Tolley is probably more like 5-6 miles per hour. And then Schlittler, depending upon when you start to do this, it's probably as much as 9.
I would say it's very legitimate that we're not even going to, like, we're saying when he was being scouted, right? Like, not, hey, there was his first start of his freshman year and he was 88 or whatever. But by the time he was being scouted for pro ball, we're still talking 90 and touching 2s and 3s.
Yeah, right? It was like 92 in the first, right? Like, so it always typically, unless you're Carlos Rodon, it almost always drops down. He's one of the few guys I saw hit his peak velocity in like the fifth inning, but
Justin Verlander is another one of those, yeah, you know,
exactly. Just some of those kind of guys. But yeah, I mean, he was 90, 92, maybe scrape a 3, you know, and I saw him multiple times in that 2021 summer. So this goes to show.
Yeah, it does go to show. But so we've talked about standout rookie pitchers, but before we go, we're going to talk about some of the second half breakout hitters that we saw in the big leagues right after this quick break.
FT fam, another reason why you should love Arena Club is the grading system. So you recently pulled a slab pack and then you said, hey, it's not graded. Grade it for me. They gave you an 8.5 out of 10 on your auto Whitey Ford card. And then they show you all the details of the grading system. It's very interactive within the app. And then you're done. If you want to sell the card or you want to know what it's worth, you've got it.
It's like getting taken to school on cards. And I think that's the coolest part of it. If you're young or old, you understand, hey, this is how it gets deciphered all the way through. It shows you the numbers and how they went through it. I think that's the coolest part about this whole thing. And then you can keep it traded or sell it, do whatever you want.
And it's so much more efficient to do this through Arena Club. Whether you're ripping a pack, there's the slab packs, buying a card, selling a card, grading a card. It's all there for you. We talk about it all season long. ArenaClub.com/FOUL is where you can go to give it a shot. 20% off your first card purchase. ArenaClub.com/FOUL. Use the code FOUL at checkout and get 20% off.
So Jeff, when we're looking at hitters who kind of, I wouldn't say in all these cases put themselves back on the radar, but I would say more guys who took steps forward that we want to look at. Okay, I would say that we're putting, we can describe this as kind of true or false. Like, was this second half breakout the sign of what's to come, or was this a player at the top of their ability level? Let's start this. A's catcher, Shea Langeliers, who I would say in his case is an example of a guy who we've been waiting for this to kind of happen, I would say in some ways. We saw it now. We've seen the power, a little bit better hitting, but what do you see and what do you think is the prognosis that Langeliers will carry this into the future?
Yeah, I think pretty clearly at this point, you can bank on 25 homers. And 30 isn't a crazy ceiling. 29 last year, 31 this year, 22 the year before. I think the funny thing with Langeliers is the catching hasn't been as good as we expected it to be. He's been kind of a negative to like even defender behind the plate, which it was kind of a defense over the bat profile when he initially, you know, came out of school at Baylor. I think people thought he could hit, but just didn't know how much. It's more of a bat over. He's a bat first catcher now. And I don't think I necessarily ever thought I would say that. The big jump this year was pretty drastic improvement from a swing and miss perspective. Had a career high batting average of 224 in 2024, jumped all the way up to 277 this year. It was only a 290 batting average on balls in play. So it wasn't like it was outrageously lucky. You know, the angles remained really good. Hard hit rate, all that stuff was the same. So it wasn't like he sacrificed some contact, you know, for power, for contact. The zone contact numbers were up a little bit. The overall contact numbers were up a little bit. He actually chased more than he ever had previously. So some of that stuff kind of doesn't fully track in terms of where the strikeout rate is. Like, yeah, there were improvements, but there wasn't a huge improvement in terms of like O swing or chase rate that we typically see that's synonymous with these sort of jumps for players like this who have like a 30% chase rate historically. He was still kind of right in line with what his historical numbers were. He simply made more contact outside of the zone and in the zone, which does give me a little bit of pause in terms of how real this sub 20% K rate is. Do I think there were skill improvements? Yes. Do I think he's somebody that during the season kind of exceeded that 1500 plate appearance number when we see guys kind of really adjust to the major leagues? Yeah, he did. I just don't think I could bank on anything above like a 240 average. I think he made tangible changes that it's not going to be a near 30% strikeout rate going forward. I still think there's some more strikeouts here. And I still think this is a profile, especially with catcher, where from year to year, the wear and tear these guys take, I just don't know if it's an investment. If you're drafting him as a no doubt 30 home run bat, on par with, you know, prime Sal Perez. I don't think it falls in line with that. And I tend to always fall back on look for the catcher with skills and a long runway in terms of at bats that maybe is coming off a down season. And that's the guy you should go after. Depending on how Langeliers is priced, I probably will stay away from him because I do think he's probably going to push a little bit higher than I'm comfortable taking, especially with a guy who doesn't walk all that much. And there's still some kind of red flags in the underlying numbers when it comes to approach.
One thing I did check with him is I wondered how much of it was the park, but no, home road splits are not that, you know, it's really actually a little better on the road than at home. So it's not the getting to play at Sacramento or anything like that.
Yeah. And I think that's definitely a benefit, but like you said, it's not like the numbers jump tremendously. There is obviously some batting average on balls in play and just batted ball luck that you're going to get at that park versus Oakland, which was one of the worst where you had massive foul territory. Like, I think that was always something people forgot is like, it's really hard to hit 300 when you were hitting in Oakland because of like how many outs you make that are typically in the stands.
No, I that's exactly where I was going to go with this too, which is it may just be, again, I think what you're saying is this was probably an 85th percentile outcome for Langoliers this year, but it doesn't mean that there may not be part of the real improvement. Maybe he improved, but part of it also maybe he's been freed from losing, you know, again, especially for a guy who hits the ball in the air, losing like 10, you know, 15 outs a year, potentially even of, man, that foul territory was huge at Oakland Memorial Coliseum. But that's kind of a one that I would say is kind of, I would say one of the breakouts. I would say Bryce Terang was a bigger one. And this one, I would say, I'm going to tee you off by saying, I know that there was something that does feel more like a sustainable jump, which is when hitters swing the bat, are able to swing the bat consistently harder, good things often do happen. And we did see, I think, a 4-mile-an-hour increase in his bat speed this year on average. But what can we expect? Is this the new Bryce Terang that we can expect going forward, or was this probably him being a little bit at the upper end of what he can do?
No, I actually think there's tangible skill changes that happened here and improvements, and they happened at an age where you would anticipate that would happen at 25, after he's had over 1,000 plate appearances in the big leagues. And he made the kind of, like, the skills were always there. There was never any question that Terang could put the bat in the ball, made pretty good swing decisions. He was an aggressive hitter. He was a guy that tried to put the ball in play. He wasn't a walk machine. But the underlying stuff was there. It was always a matter of he kind of doesn't have enough impact. Well, that changed this year. it was a 4+ mile per hour jump in average EV. That's in line with the jump that we saw on max EV. His angles got better, and it was the highest barrel rate of his career by like 70% over the one of the largest samples of his career. So I think you look at all that. You look at some other changes in terms of how his plate appearances went. O-swing went down from 28% to 23.6%. He made harder contact more consistently. He swung a little bit less, but it was like 2.6% that there's a much bigger delta on what the O-swing difference is versus what the swing difference is. So like in-zone swing rate really didn't change all that much. Still a really low swinging strike rate, though it did go up from 5.6 to 8.5. It's still within a range that he makes so much contact that him trading a little bit of contact for power, adding a little swing and miss to get better angles, more barrels, that translated to a lot bigger production for him. And I think when we tell the story of this Brewers team in 2025, he kind of gets lost in the shuffle a little bit. He might have been one of the most impactful, important players in that lineup on a day-to-day basis. The defense is pretty good. It was down in terms of the gradings this year, but that stuff can fluctuate from year to year. We know he's a pretty good second baseman. He was a 4.4 WAR player per F4 this year. 18 home runs, 24 stolen bases, hit 288. I think it's a sustainable 288. Yeah, it was a 356 batting average on balls in play, but he's a guy that spreads it around, makes a lot of contact, hitting the ball at better angles, hitting the ball a lot harder at those better angles. That's all going to translate to a higher batting average on balls in play. He runs really well, stole 50 bases in 2024, was down to 24 this year, but it came with power. It came with more runs scored. It came with more RBIs. He had a phenomenal year across the board. Do I think he necessarily matches these counting stats one for one next year? I don't know. I don't know if those RBIs are the same. It wouldn't shock me if he's still in that 15 to 20 home run range. And there's maybe even some more upside in terms of stolen bases that it could be somewhere between that 50 and 24 number next year in the 30s, something along those lines. The run number, which I think is something that is arguably the most predictive counting stat in standard 5x5 roto leagues in terms of are you going to get production from this guy? He's a guy that can score 100 runs. Had 97 this year. hitting at the top of that lineup, I don't think that that is all that unsustainable. I tend to believe in Terang. Like I said, I don't know if it's going to be a one for one season in 26 based on what he did in 24, but I mean 25. But there's real reasons to believe in the power. There's no reason to believe that he's not going to be a 25 steal type of guy, or not, you know, score 80 plus to 100 runs. When you kind of add that up, you're stuffing a lot of categories here that really the only question mark is he going to repeat 81 RBIs? Even if that ticks down a little bit and you're getting a lot of runs, you're getting the home runs, you're getting the stolen bases, and you have a really high batting average floor, I tend to think that Terang is probably going to rank really highly in our second base rankings. And I was somebody that wasn't particularly enthused about Terang as a prospect. We see a lot of players like this. I would say like 1 in 10 actually see it come to fruition like this. But when it does, these guys can be sustainable fantasy stars for a decade plus.
66 mile an hour average bat speed last year, 70 this year. Still below average, but at the same time, it just, again, when you say like the EV improvements, he's swinging the bat harder and he's making harder contact. So that makes sense. Speaking of middle infielders, though, this to me, this is going to be one of the most interesting and challenging evaluations for fantasy owners of the offseason, which is Colson Montgomery, who, let's just start with, Colson Montgomery was what the White Sox have needed for a long time, which was from a purely, you know, actual on the field standpoint. He gave them above average defense at shortstop while also being by far their best power hitter. Sign me up as far as if I'm the White Sox, it's like, wait, we have a young, impactful middle infielder. That's something that this team desperately needed. And when you look at it, he hits the ball really hard. When you look at it, he swings the bat really hard. And then when you look at it, he also strikes out a lot. The contact rate's not great. How sustainable do you think this is going forward?
This is the question of the offseason. Like, this one racks my brain because in a lot of ways, the production at least was in line with what we thought he was entering last season. And then his time over 180 games at AAA was terrible. I don't think there's a better way to put it. It was really bad production. And it was really bad production in an international league that benefits hitters. Some of this production was when there were still the full ABS, which really benefited hitters. And then the rest of it was with the challenge system. So he had that benefit of a better strike zone. Charlotte's a great park to hit in. He didn't hit. Things seemed off. Now, he had a hand injury that he played through, and he changed the knob of his bat this year. But even those first 55 games in Charlotte, 218, 298, 435. So the power was there.
Which, hold on. You have to throw in there. He was demoted back to the complex to kind of do a reset. It was, I mean, so from both sides. So from the, it was bad, but there was this kind of demarcation point where they said, this is not going right. They sent him down. They worked with him. And we have seen a new and improved Colson Montgomery since then.
Yeah.
Who still strikes out close to 30%.
Yeah, the swing and miss is still super concerning. I mean, it wasn't like, he was only 239 batting average. So a lot of it was the power. It was a 290 ISO. But from an ex-Wobicon standpoint, you believe in it. I mean, 14.4% barrel rate, which is really high, 44% hard hit rate. The expected slug was 523 to a 529 slug. So like the slugging was right in line, 243 batting average. The angles and the power can go a long way. But you need to consistently hit the ball. And he kind of has just enough of a sample size that you're starting to believe it, but still not enough of a sample size that you're like, has the league adjusted to this guy yet? Because there's not a whole lot you got to worry about in that lineup besides Colson Montgomery. So I don't know how, you know, crazy their pregame work was against this guy. But it's a 15.4% swing strike rate, which is really, really high. Zone contact is 82%, which is okay, like tolerable. He still chases out of the zone, 28.2% O swing, which is about major league average. But his O contact is really, really low. And that obviously drives down the overall contact rate to below 70%, which is typically a red flag. Once you get below 71%, then I start to get a little concerned. The angles were good here. The power was good here. I think this is somebody that nobody's going to plan to draft this year, JJ, but it will get to a point in drafts where you're going to look at that power production in the 21 home runs in 71 games, and you're going to take a chance on it. And this could go either way. I mean, the skill stuff could improve. We could see a closer version to what we saw in 2023 when he was one of the best young hitters in the minors. The underlying contact and approach numbers were really good at that point in time. Or we could see a version of this year with some homers and maybe worse strikeouts and maybe worse luck. But he's kind of towing that line of he has to make enough contact, because that's the only skill that he has right now. Is when he does make contact, the quality of contact is excellent. He's not walking all that much. He strikes out quite a bit. This just feels like one where there's a lot of luck factors that could tank this. It's almost like second half Matt Wallner. We didn't get that as much this year, but the previous 2 years, he had great second halves and was terrible in the first half. It doesn't feel like, just from a hitting, not position-wise, there are different positions, et cetera. Just from a hitting perspective, looking at it from fantasy, they don't feel that different. That this feels like a profile that has a ton of red flags, that it's almost a draft avoid, but it could be one that in a year we look back and say, maybe we should have took that shot. Like, there is upside here. I'm not going to deny that, but there's also a ton of downside. And that typically isn't a great way to draft.
I would say if you're comparing, I like the Wallner comparison. What I would point out, though, is in the case of Wallner, if he's not hitting, he's going to get more sporadic playing time, to where it's hurting you because you're not getting production, but it's only hurting you so much because it's not dragging you down. Whereas Colson Montgomery, with his defense, with him doing already what he did, right, the upside of him next year could be, I drafted relatively late, I paid for an auction, whatever it is, one of the best power hitting shortstops in the game, and I got him at a cheap price. The downside is, this guy's killing me, because week in and week out, he's playing 5 to 6 days a week and he's hitting a buck 80, you know, and he's striking out a lot and he's doing all these things where you're going to get power no matter what. I think that's clear, but the variance here on what you could get as far as everything else is really dramatic. It's going to be a fun evaluation. I would say, to kind of, you know, to wrap this up, to throw another guy at you. We saw a lot. We've seen, you know, if you said to someone coming into this year, predict which Miami Marlins are going to be the standouts, the breakouts, I think you could have thrown out 15 different names, 20, you know, and some of them did, to their credit. But how much should we count on Jacob Marcy going forward?
Oh, this is a tough one, because I feel like it was a name that had a lot of buzz coming out of AFL maybe 2 years ago, right? Had a pretty good year in the lower levels, ends up getting traded to Miami, has, you know, I think somewhat of an injury, an underwhelming 2024. Like, it wasn't a bad year in terms of like WRC plus, but he hit 200 with a 115 ISO. Came out this year in 25, had a pretty good year with AAA, was showing more power. He's an excellent base runner, so there's speed there as well. Comes up to the Marlins and had a really good second half. Hit 292, 363, 478 over 55 games, 5 home runs, 14 stolen bases, was caught 6 times, so the success rate wasn't phenomenal. But I tend to believe that, you know, the EVs were up a lot over the last couple of years. Less events, but, you know, his max EV was up. His average EV was up almost 6 miles per hour. His hard hit rate was up substantially. There's still not a ton of power there, though, that I don't know how much I believe in this one. This could be another one where I'm sort of out on it and then skills continue to improve. This one seems like a similar type of Bryce Turang breakout, but not one with like the underlying skills there, or even like his power was so much lower. It was like 20 power where Turang's like 40. Right. And he made a jump to 50. This was like a jump from a 20 to a 40. He's really passive. He doesn't swing him and chase outside the zone. Doesn't swing a whole lot. The zone contact is incredibly high. So like all that stuff is there. I just don't know how much I believe that he's consistently going to hit for impact. Now, some of that might be old perceptions of Marseille because the underlying numbers don't necessarily screen that. But it was a 357 batting average on balls in play during his MLB tenure. And that's just not in line with the production that we've seen in the minor leagues from him. This was more or less the best production that we've seen from Marseille since he was in high A. So I just don't know how much I tend to believe that. It's pretty decent defense that could keep him out there. It's Miami where they're looking for guys like this that are, you know, kind of the grinder types that do a little bit of everything well. It just screams a little platoony to me. If things go off the rails, he's not somebody necessarily they're going to stick with, but I could be wrong. It was a really good pro debut, or major league debut, excuse me.
If I could summarize that, what you're saying here is like, look, this is a guy who there's a high variance. There's a chance that this is a real skill development breakthrough. There's a chance that this was a little bit more of a short, small sample size anomaly. But as opposed to someone like Turang, this is someone where if you're wrong by not taking him, by not getting him, you're going to miss out on something modest. If you're wrong by acquiring him, drafting him, you know, paying for him, whatever, you could pay off, but it's going to be it's a much more modest payoff. Is it not, right? This is one of those where it's like, if you're wrong, okay, you're going to probably jettison him and move on to someone else. If you're right, he's a useful player on your roster, but it's not no one's going to be coming out of next year and say, hey, I won. And why did I win? I won because I hit it on Jacob Marcy.
I mean, if he hits 15 home runs and hits for a high average and steals 50 bases, then, you know, maybe somebody says that, but I don't think you feel real comfortable
that's going to happen. You know, so that's, I mean, again, we talked about some hitters. We talked about some pitchers. It is, as you said, it is the dead time for fantasy baseball right now. It is the time to get prepared for next year. We think about baseball year round. So, you know, we're going to talk about it. So for Jeff, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.